It's Friday, January 17, 2014. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. Sex is not our problem, so writes Charles M. Blow in a column that appeared in last Saturday's edition of The New York Times. As this week comes to an end, I want to look at two articles that appeared in recent days in The New York Times, both about sex. Not so much for what they say about sex, but for what they say about The New York Times, about the cultural elite, and about ourselves. Charles M. Blow writes in this column entitled, Sex is Not Our Problem. He says, there is often a simplistic black or white conservative versus progressive discussion around the dissolution of the traditional family and high single parent birth rates in America and what these trends may portend for us as a country. Well, he's certainly right about that. And when you think about the cultural issues in this country, there are indeed two polarities. And it is not by accident that quite frequently those two polarities face off, and they face off in very stark terms. He says, however, quote, I don't see the argument as completely binary or the problem as intractable, but I do believe that we must focus more on complex areas of causation. We can't look longingly at the halcyon ideals of yore, where marriage held more primacy and premarital sex was considered more depraved, end quote. Well, think about that sentence for just a moment. What does it mean for giving up on the halcyon days, as he said, when marriage was held in higher esteem and premarital sex was considered, to use his words, more depraved? Well, just how depraved is it considered these days? Well, in most circles, certainly those circles of the cultural elite, premarital sex is just considered the way things are. It's just the rule of the world. In other words, it's not considered sinful in any sense. As a matter of fact, recent articles that have appeared in the mainstream media have suggested that it is now simply out of time, out of place, out of bounds to even talk about the morality of premarital sex. Marriage itself has been so marginalized from that discussion that the issue is just how should premarital sex or non-marital sex be orchestrated between two mutually consenting adults. Furthermore, as the mainstream media will make very clear, these don't have to be adults. The mainstream media overwhelmingly suggest that we simply have to give in to the fact that teenagers are going to have sex. And thus, what we should worry about, and Charles M. Blow is making this very point, is simply that they practice so-called safe sex. He goes on and says about those days when those halcyon ideals of yore, when marriage was held in more primacy and premarital sex was considered more depraved, he says, quote, those days are gone, but there are ways for us to adjust to a new reality rather than simply bemoan it, end quote. Now that as well is a very interesting statement. In other words, we simply have to take the moral status as it is now and freeze frame it and say we're going to have to deal with it and accept it because this is the new reality and thus we have to have a new morality. Well, just consider how the cultural elite is selective in dealing with those issues. For instance, on the issue of homosexuality, they're not saying this is morality as it is, we need to hold it here and not move, we need to adjust to this reality. Instead, they're saying we need to change the reality. Now, before we throw the liberals and progressives under the bus, we need to recognize that cultural conservatives, moral conservatives, even Christian conservatives, can use the same kind of arguments. In other words, we have to be careful that we're not arguing for morality either simply because it is or it isn't. In other words, we shouldn't be arguing for a moral status that is simply because it is, nor should we be arguing for a moral status that is not yet simply because it must be better than what is. There has to be an objective standard by which these moral principles are decided, and that moral standard for Christians is the revealed Word of God. And, of course, an entire tradition and heritage of two millennia of Christian thinking on the basis of Scripture about these issues. But the cultural left is so insistent on personal autonomy in matters of human sexuality that they argue, just as Charles M. Blow is arguing here, that what we have to do is simply accept that people are going to have sex. They're going to have sex without marriage, before marriage. They're going to have sex as adults. They're going to have sex as teenagers. So we just need to deal with it and create a new morality that isn't about what you ought to do, as in not having sex without marriage, but instead how to have sex more morally. Now, another thing to note from this article is how Charles Blow says he doesn't want this reduced to binary options. That means to two options. This is a very interesting argument that is increasingly being used by cultural progressives. It's a way of saying there aren't just two positions, there are a myriad of positions, a continuum of positions. Now, what this does effectively is shift the argument to the left, but incrementally. One of the things we need to note is that it's very difficult to shift the argument to the right incrementally. In other words, if you operate out of a revealed ethic, it's very hard to say we'll be satisfied with making just a little bit of progress toward that moral ideal, that moral command. In other words, the binary option is actually more fixed than Charles Blow and many other progressives would like to make us think. and those who argue for a continuum are almost always arguing for a continuum they know is moving in their direction. In other words, it's not just a continuum, it's a moving trajectory. But having suggested that there are more options than two, he writes, "Now, there are things I assume most Americans still agree on. Most think young people should delay sexual activity until they are mentally and emotionally capable of reasonably consenting and comprehending the consequences. Most want fewer children born to parents unwilling to provide for those children or incapable of doing so, emotionally or financially. Most want fewer unplanned and unwanted pregnancies, and most want fewer women to have to face the often wrenching decisions about what to do about such pregnancies," end quote. Well, in the sense that Americans might be asked questions on a survey about matters of sexuality, he might be right that Americans are going to be found all over the spectrum. But in terms of how these issues actually operate, they're more resistantly binary than he wants to think. Notice also how he shifts the moral ground here, and he does so in a way that no doubt makes sense to him, and he anticipates, to the majority of readers of the New York Times. Speaking of young people, of teenagers, he said, "We agree, most of us agree, that teenagers should delay sexual activity until, well, marriage? No. Instead, quote, they are mentally and emotionally capable of reasonably consenting and comprehending the consequences," end quote. Now, what kind of sexual morality is that? It's the sexual morality of the safe sex movement. It's the sexual morality of most sex education is taught in most public schools. It's the sexual morality of Planned Parenthood. It's the sexual morality, furthermore, of most in the social work community and most psychotherapists and psychologists who simply hold to the understanding that teenagers are going to have sex and what they need to be encouraged to do is to have sex responsibly, consensually. One of the things to note here is the radical distinction between the Christian worldview based upon revealed principles, statutes, commands, laws, moral teachings, and on the other hand, what you have is this gradient of moral principles, or of principles in the making, ambiguous and vague though they may be. You'll notice that the decision-making on the part of the Christian is actually tremendously simplified. Christians understand that sex is to be enjoyed within the context of heterosexual marriage, and in no other context. That really cuts down on the complexity. In other words, Christians who operate by the Christian worldview and by the law of Christ understand that there is actually very little that needs to be comprehended other than the reality of the biblical principle and of the very command of Christ. Charles Bowlow then goes on to talk about pregnancy, and he says, "Most of us want fewer children born to parents unwilling to provide for those children or incapable of doing so." He then adds, "emotionally or financially. Most want fewer unplanned and unwanted pregnancies." Now, what is he talking about here? Well, that becomes abundantly clear, frighteningly clear, ominously clear, when you look at the right hand of his column. As printed in Saturday's edition of the New York Times, the singular issue addressed in the right column in a graphic is abortion. And the singular message it sends is that restrictions on abortion are actually curtailing the rights of women to have access to abortion in order to have fewer unwanted and unplanned pregnancies. The wording in that column is this: according to the Guttmacher Institute, 22 states enacted 70 abortion restrictions during 2013. This makes 2013 second only to 2011 in the number of new abortion restrictions enacted in a single year. To put trends in even sharper relief, 205 abortion restrictions were enacted over the past 3 years, but just 189 were enacted during the entire previous decade, 2001 to 2010. In other words, you don't have to be able to comprehend very much to get the point, not only of Charles Bowlow in this op-ed, but of the New York Times in putting that graphic next to it. Later in his article, he writes this, quote, "Conservatives often stress marriage as a panacea for many of these problems, and indeed, marriage has its benefits. The fewer partners one engages sexually, the lower the risk of encountering disease. And in terms of having a child, two adults in a home can often do twice as much as one. But we must respect all family structures and encourage all parents to be active and engaged in child rearing, regardless of living arrangements," end quote. The most interesting portion of that, of course, is the statement that we must respect all family structures. Now, again, that's one of those statements you have to wonder if the author actually means. Well, in this case, he well might. But does he mean polygamous relationships? Multiple families? Does he mean cohabitation? What exactly does he mean? Well, what he actually means in this context is quite clear. He means that all family relationships, all romantic couplings, all forms of raising children, all family contexts are beyond moral scrutiny. All have to be equally respected. That's another very interesting statement, and as I said, I don't actually believe he means exactly what he says here. But he does say it, and he does mean it to the extent that he would include virtually everything we could think of that is so far generally accepted by the mainstream liberal society. Finally, he writes, furthermore, much of the discussion about single-parent families and births outside of marriage is focused too heavily on young women and is simply a form of sex shaming that blames them for not being proper guardians of chastity. The shaming itself is a shame and often inflames the pathology of patriarchy in our culture. End quote. Well, that's really not all that surprising. That's the kind of argument to which we're accustomed when we look to the New York Times or to the cultural left. It's the argument that says that many criticisms of family relationships are just disguised forms of patriarchy or of sexual shaming or as a form of what many on the left will call blaming the victim. Well, the reality is there are victims here. The victims are children born to mothers who aren't married. The victims are children who have pathologies that are statistically undeniable in terms of a greater risk of not finishing school, a greater risk of going to jail, a greater risk of getting into trouble, a greater risk of getting pregnant, a greater risk of many things that are simply undebatable when it comes to the statistics. But even to raise these issues in many cultural contexts is to be accused of blaming the victim. And cultural conservatives, Christian conservatives in particular, are going to have to be very aware that dealing with these issues often will get us into trouble simply for saying what we know to be true. On the other hand, to be intimidated by the cultural left from saying what we know to be true that leads to greater human happiness and greater human flourishing is to deny what Christ told us when he gave those two most important commandments. The first was love of God, but the second was love of neighbor. And love of neighbor means we have to speak the truth. We try our very best to speak the truth in love. But we speak the truth, even when doing so, is to be accused of patriarchy or blaming the victim. If nothing else, an article like this by Charles Blow demonstrates just how far the cultural and moral discussion in this country has moved. Because what we're looking at in this article that appears in the New York Times is something that to the readers of that paper was expected to be uncontroversial. In other words, if this isn't where you are, you're just not where the New York Times would have you to be. Or you're at least not there yet. Meanwhile, speaking of not being there yet, an article that appeared in Monday's edition of the same paper by Sarah Elizabeth Richards announces, quote, the next frontier in fertility treatment. But before I tell you what it is, I want you to hear how she introduces the story. Quote, Andy Inkster, a transgender man, had always wanted biological children. So when he embarked upon the transition from female to male at age 18, changing his name, taking testosterone, and eventually undergoing surgery to remove his breasts, he left his female reproductive organs intact. In his mid-20s, he decided it was time. He stopped taking testosterone and started trying to get pregnant. Eventually, in 2009, after beginning graduate school at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst, he sought fertility treatment at Bay State Reproductive Medicine. Bay State was one of the few clinics in the country with an anti-discrimination policy for gender identity, and yet it refused to treat him, arguing that it didn't have enough expertise to treat transgender patients. Mr. Inkster insisted there was no medical reason to deny him. His baby-making parts were the same as any woman's, end quote. Now, you'll understand why I needed to read those two paragraphs exactly as they were written, because exactly as they are written is how we are to take them. And exactly as they are written demonstrates the cultural and moral insanity that is now deeply embedded in our society. Those two paragraphs about the rights of a person born a woman who decided to become a man, but to keep a female reproductive system to have full access to reproductive technologies tells us that we're in a brave new world that is far beyond where even the cultural left could have imagined us being just a matter of a decade or so ago. So the rights of transgendered persons to fertility treatment is the so-called next frontier that Sarah Elizabeth Richards is writing about. Later in the article, she writes this, quote, admittedly, the idea of a pregnant man makes many people uncomfortable, and photos of Mr. Inkster caressing his bulging belly are startling. The issue is controversial even within the transgender community. She then cites Jameson Green, the author of a book entitled Becoming Visible Man, quote, some people believe if you're a trans man, you shouldn't be wanting to bear kids. That's not something men do. Others think if you have a body part that does something, why can't you use it? It's your body, end quote. Richards then writes this, quote, the issue brings up unprecedented questions. Do you use your genetic material to reproduce? And at what time during your transition? Before or after hormone therapy? Before undergoing reassignment surgery that will make you sterile? Should a transgender man like Mr. Inkster keep those parts that will allow him to nurse later? Is it generally psychologically healthier for someone like him to freeze his eggs and have them inseminated and the embryos transferred to a female partner or surrogate rather than leave his female reproductive parts intact? How might years of estrogen or testosterone therapy affect eggs or sperm? End quote. Well, quite honestly, those are questions that not even Sarah Elizabeth Richards tries to answer. She simply says, those are pressing questions. And of course they are. They're the very questions that led that fertility clinic in Massachusetts to say, we don't even have any expertise for this. What we're looking at here is the next step, not the end result. The end result's not even in view. But the next step, towards the progressive denial of the order of creation in gender, in marriage, and in sexuality, to the extent that it makes sense to the person who wrote this article and to those who are now activists for a revolution in transgender fertility treatment, to say that it makes perfect sense for someone to transition to the gender he or she was not born with in order yet to keep the body parts that would allow reproduction, so that in this case, a man can get pregnant and have a baby, such that in this case you have a person born a woman who became supposedly a man, but a man who kept a female reproductive system and now wants that system to be used, even if it requires fertility treatment, to have a child. Now remember, Charles Blow said we had to treat all family structures with equal respect. So let me just let you anticipate how this article ends, also in the same paper, the New York Times. Richards writes, "The bigger challenge may be to get medical providers to overcome their bias. Discomfort over difference isn't an excuse to refuse compassionate care to a transgender person in an emergency room or a fertility clinic, or for insurance companies to refuse to cover that care." The last sentence, "Gender identity has nothing to do with the desire to have children or with who will make a good parent," end quote. And remember, that sentence was written to conclude an extended essay about a woman who became a man in order to remain a mother, and now wants fertility treatment in order to achieve it. Finally, the Wall Street Journal at the end of this week had an article about parents, but it wasn't about transgender parenting or fertility treatments. It was about, here's the headline, "The Power of Parents Who Say No." Catherine Pohlman writes in this opinion piece for the Wall Street Journal that one of the most essential acts of the parent, of the compassionate, loving parent, is to learn to say no to his or her own children. She writes, quote, "It isn't especially hard for my husband and I to decide what we think are the right choices for our children. No, the challenge is having to deal with the unhappy child when he/she doesn't get what he/she wants." Now, I'm going to put aside just how respectful and obedient and wonderful your children are, and imagine that if you're honest, you face some of the same moments, especially as your children transition from school age to adolescent. She writes, "Were I to record a montage of my children's responses after hearing the word no, it would sound something like this. But why can't we watch YouTube videos? Why can't I have a cell phone? Why can't I have a fifth dessert? Why can't we drink soda, have a video game, stay up later, join the country club?" Inevitably, the response to my retort is, "But all the other kids are allowed," end quote. She writes, "When my kids were young, it was a manageable backlash, but now as they age, the pressure to fit in grows exponentially, and so does the parenting pressure. Sometimes I just want to take the easy route. I want to give in. Parenting is exhausting, and why fight the little stuff? But then I realize not being able to stand my ground on soda will make it so much harder to hang tough about the bigger issues like internet safety and dating." As you might imagine, Catherine Pohlman then goes back to her own childhood and her own mother. She writes, "Although I couldn't see it as a child, I now realize how amazing my mom was all those years ago. She knew what she thought was best, and she didn't care if I hated her for it. That strong parenting." She goes on to write, "My childhood disappointments and restrictions actually taught me valuable life lessons that I'm trying to pass on to my kids." She details those lessons in this article, and then she comes to conclude, "Lastly, I learned that having every desired item doesn't make one happy. There are other ways for me to be fulfilled. I'm gratified by working, helping a neighbor, being a good friend, cooking, drawing with chalk on the driveway, and playing the piano beside my daughter. I think this kind of happiness was learned in childhood." In other words, that kind of happiness is learned in a childhood where a parent, indeed both parents, learn that magic word, no. We're living in a society, as those articles in the New York Times we discussed makes clear, where it's almost impossible now for people to say no. That's what makes me look at Pohlman's article and say, I think she's got something exactly right. If you lose the ability to say no in the small things, you inevitably lose the ability to say no for the big things. That's not only true for parents with their own children, it's true for an entire society. Our inability as a society to say the things we know were true has now led us to the point that we don't believe, as a society, that anything's true. We lost our ground on the small things or gave it up, and now we've lost ground on the big issues as well. Just consider the moral revolution that has to already have occurred for that headline about the transgender fertility frontier to make any sense at all. Pohlman concludes, "The peer pressure your child encounters in school to have the in item or the latest technology or the most freedom turns into parenting peer pressure. What is hardest for me is that I know how my children will feel when I say no. It hurts. They won't understand it. They will be angry and will direct that at me. I just have to remind myself that sometimes the best lessons are the most painful," end quote. Well, as Catherine Pohlman undoubtedly knows, the pain is probably more illusory than the child would have you to think. The reality is most children actually feel secure, as we all know, in being told no, even as they find value in being told yes. Yes is not meaningful, unless it is faced with the real opportunity and possibility of no. And a society that loses that kind of moral sanity is the society in which those issues raised in the New York Times I mentioned make sense. And that ought to give us plenty to think about as we go into the weekend. Before I close, I want to invite you to join me, along with nationally syndicated radio host Dennis Prager and New York Times columnist Ross Douthat, for a conversation about faith and freedom in the public square. Our goal is to have an open and honest dialogue about the challenges we face as a nation and a civilization. It's going to be something I don't think you're going to want to miss. Join us January 28 at 7 p.m. on the campus of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. For more information and tickets, go to www.hashtagpros.com. That's #pros.com. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmohler.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Mohler. For information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, just go to sbts.edu. For information on Boyce College, just go to boycecollege.com. I'll meet you again on Monday for The Briefing.